This is Fresh Air, and you're listening to WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. It's 4 o'clock. Joining me in the studio on Fresh Air is Martin Williams, one of America's most eloquent and perceptive writers about jazz. There was a time when most of the writing about jazz was preoccupied with the atmosphere of jazz, the smoke-filled rooms, the clinking glasses, and the colorful personalities of the jazz musicians. Martin Williams wrote about jazz with great attention to the music itself, its form and movement, tones and colors. This descriptive, articulate treatment was usually reserved for discussion of classical music. But this is not to say that Williams tried to make jazz respectable by dressing it in the language of classical music. It has always been explicit or implicit in his writing that jazz does not need elevation. It is an important art. But he has emphasized the way in which jazz musicians have affected classical musicians. The trumpet section, for instance, in symphonies, he says, have not played quite the same since Armstrong. Martin Williams has been a regular contributor to the Saturday Review, the New York Times, and Downbeat. In about 1957, along with Nat Hentoff, he started the Jazz Review, a journal which was published for about 2 years. Martin Williams has also written books about jazz, including Where's the Melody? He has edited a very good series on jazz history called the Jazz Masters series, and he's also the author of The Jazz Tradition. Currently, he's the director of the Jazz and American Culture Program at the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C. There he compiled the 6-record set called the Smithsonian Collection of Classic Jazz, which follows jazz from Jelly Roll Morton through Ornette Coleman. We hear selections from the set frequently on Fresh Air. Martin Williams, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much. I'm a little overwhelmed by what you just said, so I don't know how to be modest on this occasion, so I'll just shut up.
I'd really love to know how you first started listening to jazz, what first got you listening to it.
Well, it's a funny thing, but I remember the moment when it really hit me emotionally. You know, there was lots of jazz around, because in my era, which was the so-called swing era, almost all the big bands played a lot of jazz. Actually, I think the best way to look at that, some people think that all American popular music, or most of it, was jazz in those days. It's not true. The thing was that everything came in a large package, a big band, a small group, 2 singers, a vocal group, and all that. And so you got a whole big so-called popular music package all in one thing there. But the orientation was certainly in so-called swing style jazz. I heard a lot of it. What hit me was once on Sunday afternoon radio, of all things, that deadly cultural hour of broadcasting in those days, and a show that was put on by Victor Records, and I heard Teddy Wilson and Benny Goodman, and I guess it was Gene Krupa, I don't remember, playing one of those up-tempo things by the trio, probably Tiger Rag or Running Wild, one of those things they used to play very fast, and in the middle of Teddy Wilson's solo, I sold my soul to the devil for good, because I just, that's something overwhelming to me, you know, that was the moment.
And then you had to start finding more and listening to more, and I would assume you also tried to read about it, too.
Well, I did do some reading. I did, and I can't tell you that I've read all the people who were writing about it at the time. There was one critic, and I was just saying today to a friend, I'm proud to say that I have never read so-and-so. I'm not going to mention his name on the air, but he was one of the guys who was writing, you know, when I was 4 or 5 years younger, so he was already. And I've never read a word the man wrote, but and I don't regret it to this day. But anyway, I suppose it's the way my mind works. But for one thing, I got interested in, at the same time as I was listening to Lester Young and Duke Ellington. And I'm really pleased when I look back at my own adolescence at the records that I bought. I had a lot of trashy records, and I had a lot of delusions, as we all do when we're young. But I also had a lot of marvelous records that I still listen to, you know. And some of these Ellington records that I've brought today that we'll be hearing later. I've known them since I was a teenager. But I also began to go backward, because I got interested in where these people came from and who their predecessors were. And I guess it's my mentality, as I say. And so I began to find out about earlier people and their music, too, and their recordings.
What was the jazz writing like at that time? The kinds of reviews, if any, or criticism that you could find in the newspapers and the magazines? What kind of books were around then?
Well, you could find very little in the mass magazines, practically nothing. Every now and then, it was pretty much the same story as it is now. Some journalist who worked for some big slick news magazine would discover something like Boogie Woogie, and he'd write this article, which was mostly balderdash, pretending to be knowledge and scholarship. You know, well, that's still true. I mean, you find that kind of thing. You know, somebody finds out about Chick Corea or something and writes it up in Newsweek. But in the mass magazines, there was very little. There were fan magazines, one of which still survives, called Downbeat, that was there in the 30s. In fact, Downbeat was really started as a kind of fan magazine about swing bands. And then you got a couple of so-called classical critics in this country who were not really very knowledgeable, but they were perfectly willing to take this seriously. David Hall, for instance, Irving Culloden, for instance. Every now and then they'd write something about jazz, and they were not apologetic, and they were not patronizing. You did get a handful of those. There were two or three of those in England, and there was a lot of kind of arrogantly self-righteous pronouncement-style criticism coming out of Britain and France particularly, and that's still going on, I guess. Very avid, you know, the French are always taking up an American idiom or American art or something, jazz, movies.
And, jeans.
right. And talking about it, A, as though it were maybe even a little better than it actually is. They sometimes inflate I don't mean always, but they sometimes inflate it. But that's to justify their interest. See, this has got to be artistic because I'm interested in it, so therefore, you know, I can't be interested in trash, right? And they still take that attitude, and they also always have taken the attitude that Americans really don't appreciate their own culture. Well, first of all, we do produce it, and I think we should be given some credit for that, you know. But that was the general state of thing. I did not read many of the French people. I read some of their things, and I still do. It's amazing, some of the early French writers, I was thinking about this today, they had really good taste. What they chose to pick in the way of the Louis Armstrong recordings, let's say, or the performances of Ellington, they usually picked really interesting things, but they never had any critical discussion of why they were picking them. This is the best, this is almost as good, you know, it's like making lists. But there was not very much meaty discussion going on.
What made you want to write about jazz?
I don't know. I guess maybe I'm trying to justify my own taste, too, the way I was kidding the French about doing. I don't know. I did think when I started writing that there must be another way to write about this music than what I was generally reading, which was a kind of golly gee whiz enthusiasm, you know? And I guess, again, that's the way my mind works. I don't mean that one shouldn't be enthusiastic. Heaven knows I am. But if that's all you have to say, gee whiz, I don't think you should write about something. And I thought that I had something to say that other people were not saying. And again, as you said, and I appreciate your saying this very much, I don't believe in being defensive about a thing like this. I think there's an awful lot of defensive kind of paranoid thing that still goes on when you write about American culture of any kind. And I don't see any point in that. If you really believe, for instance, that the motion picture is a form of American drama, then go ahead and act like you believe it, not act like you're trying to convince yourself of it, you know. So, but in general, I did not like most of what I read about jazz, and so I just said, well, I can do that a little better. It's sort of like being a musician in a way. It's not important compared to being an artist to write about an art. But, a young musician is always saying to himself, I think I can do that and maybe do it a little differently. Well, that's really what I was saying about writing about it to him.
You were writing reviews and analysis, but how were your reviews received? What kind of reviews of your reviews did you get? How did people react to the way you were writing about jazz?
Oh, that's an interesting story. In a way, if anybody's interested in that question at all, I think my particular the reactions to me are kind of funny. For one thing, for example, one man said he read what I wrote, and it wasn't what he was used to reading, and it wasn't the kind of thing he was writing. So he said, is Martin Williams really interested in jazz? Well, you know, I might point out that this man is now writing advertising copy for handkerchiefs and tissues, and I'm doing what I'm doing, you know, okay? And the things that have been said about, you know, Martin Williams doesn't care about anybody but Jelly Roll Morton. Oh, Martin Williams, he's that guy that doesn't like anyone but Ornette Coleman. Oh, Martin Williams, yeah, that's the Duke Ellington freak. He can't hear anybody but Ellington. And on and on and on like that, you know. Anyone I've ever praised, he had come back to me as if that was the beginning and end of everything for me, which it is not. But, okay, you know, that's all right. I think that in a way I'm lucky that I had two or three editors on magazines and in books who would let me write about the music the way that I wanted to without fooling around with my copy or advising me that you can't talk about jazz that way. Of course, people told me that. But I ran into, first of all, you start in this field the way you start in show business, really. There are always people out there who want you to write free copy. See, you start in radio that way too, right? Mm-hmm. There's always that FM station that ain't going to pay you anything.
That's
but
right.
They'll let you on the air. Okay, well, I started in radio that way too. So there were these magazines, including one classical one, that wanted me to write about jazz. So I did, and that's how I broke in. And then along came the devil and said, I'll give you money to do that, you see. Okay. And then I wasn't really looking for that, by the way, because I was trying to be an English teacher when I first started writing about jazz. I had no intention of going pro and as a critic. And I ran into Irving Kolodin at the Saturday Review, who finally said, okay, you take the page and you put in it what you want to and I'll publish it, which was marvelous for me. And Jimmy Lyons at the American Record Guide did the same thing for me. And while I lasted at the New York Times, it was that way, but I could tell they thought I was too heavy for them. And, you know, a few other people. I was very, and Evergreen Review, too, when that was a more or less serious magazine before it went into a sex book thing. They let me do it, too. Anything I wanted to say, and I wrote about other subjects in that magazine, too. And so I was lucky, but there were, you know, there was no living in this. I was hand to mouth and doing 50,000 other things to keep going. But I did have that. And when I would go to the better playing slick magazines, almost always I'd strike out. I mean, I did manage to make Harper's, but I could never have gotten anything like Playboy, because you can't talk about jazz that way. That's what they'd always tell us. That's what they used to tell us on the Jazz Review. You can't talk about jazz that way. Well, first of all, we were talking about it a lot of ways. And second of all, what do they mean you can't do it? We're doing it, aren't we? You know, it's like walking up to a musician and saying you can't play what you just played. You got to be kidding.
And by talking about it that way, I mean, that's really like looking at somebody's solo, you know, discussing the shape of it, the progression of it, the statement of it, how it fits into the melody, things like that.
Yeah, well, you make me sound like, in a way, if you forgive me for putting it, you make me sound like I'm writing musicology. I can't write musicology because I'm not a musicologist. Mm-hmm. I am only, if I'm musical, it's because I have pretty good ears and I have learned to talk about what I'm hearing and I've borrowed the terminology and that's the way it's happened to me. I could not do a really heavy analytical. I still have trouble reading. Reading is a struggle for me. Even simple things, I have to sit down and say, well, and but I do like to talk about music as music, in so far as I can, and as I've learned how to do it. And but I do it, I think, in a way that lay people who respond to music can understand, because I'm, after all, a lay person. So if I've learned this, then I can show them how that goes, you know. And I guess it's been my function. I feel it has.
I think that for a person who really loves and appreciates jazz and is also writing about jazz from a critical point of view, that person would probably be in a difficult position sometimes, kind of like torn between the wish to kind of be a kind of cheerleader for the idiom, but yeah, at the same time really wanting to like make distinctions between quality material and mediocre or poor material.
Yeah.
How have you balanced that for yourself?
Well, I don't think I am a cheerleader. I think there are plenty of cheerleaders, and if I felt it a different way and I thought there was a different way to do it, that I would do it that way. See, I figure, I don't know what my audience is, if I've got one, but I do think that there are people who read me, however many there are, and there may be very few, but that I'm reaching them in a way that most of the people who write about jazz can't reach them. So I do have that function. And I do think that that function is important. Maybe it isn't, but it seems to me it is. And that's what I do. Now, if you're looking for a cheerleader, as you put it, there are some good cheerleaders. So why should I try to be another one? You know. To me, a critic is a man who has got, who knows that his questions are how and why. Now, you can't ever, in an aesthetic subject, you can never answer that question of why this is good, why I like this, how is he doing this. But an effort to answer that question is the critic's job. And that's what I've tried to do, you know. I like the idea of getting people inside of me. You know, the most fun I have, for about 15 years, I used to teach jazz appreciation courses, mostly in adult education situations. And the most wonderful student I could get, in a way, was the record collector or the enthusiast of my generation who would... I'd go into class with something that this guy thought he knew by heart. He could probably hum you the top line of a 3-minute 78 record that he thought was a classic. And I would say, look at it this way. This is going on. That's happened. Put a little simple diagram of the arrangement on a blackboard. Not technical. Just chorus, chorus, chorus. And those people would just flip out with delight. And they would say, oh, that's what I've been liking all these years. Ah, and that gave me a lot of pleasure. You know, that really, because there, that, you give those people, you've given that person something he can never lose. If you just given a person gee whiz, he's got, that's gone in a few years. Well, that's not a part of his life from then. But if you give him, why did D.W. Griffith put this camera here and shoot in that direction? And why is that better than putting a camera over there and shooting in that direction? That's something they'll never get over. That's something that'll be a part of their watching movies for the rest of their lives. And that's what I like to try to get at.
Mm-hmm.
You know. Now, most editors of mass magazines, and you know, they don't want that kind of thing. I think they're wrong. I've always thought they were wrong, but I lucked out and got a few who didn't feel that way.
What do you think of the quality of some of the jazz journals now, and of you know the kinds of columns that people are writing for the newspapers, the few that do have columns in it for jazz, for writing about jazz?
Well, there are several young writers that I think are good, and I'm kind of pleased with how comprehensive their knowledge of the music is, because in my day you and for many generations, well, a couple of generations before mine, a couple after, what you got was the guy who to whom jazz was whatever he found when he was 15 or 16, and that was it, and that was what he knew about, and that was what he wanted to talk about. He didn't want to talk about any real innovation that came after that or anything that had happened before. We don't get that anymore. I like Gary Giddens' work very much. Gary knows the whole course of the music, and he has some taste and knowledge in all the nuances of all the styles, and he knows what's going on in a performance. He's got real understanding of that. I like J.R. Taylor, who works with me at the Smithsonian and who writes criticism. He's the same way. I like Stanley Crouch. Stanley Crouch is a musician, drummer, critic, who potentially is a great musician critic. That could happen, and I think it's high time it happened in jazz. He may not be a major drummer, I don't mean that, but he is a good performer, and if he becomes even a good critic, that's some step forward for this music.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Martin Williams, who is currently the director of the Jazz and American Culture Program at the Smithsonian Institution. He's also the author of numerous books about jazz and has written also numerous columns for periodicals about jazz. Let's listen to one of the records that you've brought with you this afternoon. One of them, the one we're going to hear now, is a newly released double album from the Smithsonian collection. It's a collection of Duke Ellington's work. Do you want to tell us a little bit about the album and about what we're going to hear?
Well, after the we put out a set of six records, which you mentioned earlier, the Smithsonian Collection of Classic Jazz, which was kind of a survey from a very definite point of view, which is ultimately my own, of course, about jazz history. And then after that, we began to make other recordings, mostly reissues, but not altogether. We have done some new work. one of the things that I've wanted to do very much was start a whole series of year-by-year two-record sets of Ellington's career. The latest one comes from 1940. It is just out. This is one of the great years for Ellington, for any American composer. It's an astonishing body of music for one man to have done in one year. In which year, I might add, the audience of fans, of course, was listening to Glenn Miller and not to Duke Ellington. I don't want to berate that group of people too heavily, but I think that's worth pointing out. And what I suggested that we play was three selections from this that make a kind of suite. The first one is a blues piece, which is called Sepia Panorama, and it was Ellington's theme for a while. And the second one is a very slow so-called mood piece called Dusk. It's a marvelous piece of programmatic writing, if you will, because it is dusk, you know. Even little bird warbles in it. And then the final thing is that rousing piece for Ben Webster's tenor saxophone called Cottontail. Thank you.
Three selections from a new album that has been released from the Smithsonian collection. We heard Duke Ellington and his orchestra, Sepia Panorama, Dusk, and Cottontail. My guest, if you're just joining us, is Martin Williams, who is the director of the Jazz and American Culture Program at the Smithsonian, and what we just heard is a selection from one of the albums that he has brought with him. Martin Williams has also written extensively about jazz in books and periodicals. And if you are aware of the Smithsonian collection of classic jazz, the six-record set, he has written with that about a 46-page booklet that is in itself a really excellent introduction to jazz history. It really spans all the periods of jazz from Jelly Roll Morton to Ornette Coleman. When you were introducing the Ellington selections that we heard, you mentioned that the first piece that we heard, Sepia Panorama, is a blues, and I thought I would just ask you, so what is a blues?
That is a question I think well worth asking and answering for Americans, because first of all, a lot of people in this country think, or at least a few people pretend to think they know what that word means, or they know what you mean by that word. Everybody in this country knows the blues, however, and many don't know that they know it. By that I mean this. It's, first of all, it is the only original musical form of music that's grown up in this country. It is 12 measures long, and it goes in cycles, to be technical about it. Most of our musical forms, the two versions we use of song form and variations, are borrowed from Europe. This is American. It is not African. It is not European. It's American. It's one of the most pervasive musical facts in the world. It is heard all over the world today, and people in Tokyo and London and Paris and Johannesburg and everywhere want to play and sing the blues. So that's really a triumphant kind of cultural fact. It's got to be. Most people know it because they know pieces that are in blues form, but they've never maybe thought about the form. For instance, to my generation, 1 o'clock jump, a woodchopper's ball, a sent for you yesterday, that's all the blues. Why don't you do right? That's the blues. A little bit later, rock around the clock, or you ain't nothing but a hound dog, or shake, rattle, and rope, that's the blues. Every day is the blues. Ball and chain is the blues. Your mama don't dance is the blues. And on and on and on. It accounts for perhaps 40% of the music played in the world in any given year, that musical form. And, of course, now I'm talking about quantity. And, of course, that has to mean something, because if all of these people all over the world and from all these different cultures suddenly want to do this, it's and want to hear it and want to play it and want to sing it, that's got to mean something. It's got to mean something very important, but in terms of quality, then alone. Well, that first Ellington piece is really a miniature masterpiece of instrumental writing and performance and orchestration. And there are many of Ellington's best pieces that are in blues form, and that would apply to almost every jazz musician. Charlie Parker, I suppose 40% of what he played was blues. Louis Armstrong, same kind of thing. So it's both, well, obviously I've already implied that it's both a vocal and instrumental form, and the word blues need not appear in the title for it to be in blues form. In fact, actually, there are some pieces that do have the word blues in the title that aren't, strictly speaking, blues. But, it seems to me, there's no way in the world that I could teach someone to recognize the blues. I mean, ultimately, they got to take the reins and do it themselves. It's not hard to do. Even for people who aren't musical, because I wasn't musical at all when I began to figure out that all these pieces were actually in the same musical form, and I found out what the name was and so forth. But I think we all should. I really do. In fact, if we can't recognize it when we hear it, we at least ought to know about it, because it's so terribly important. It's really a kind of cultural miracle that has come out of Afro-American life in the United States. You know, oh Lord, 50% of the rock and roll music 10 years ago was in blues form.
Mm-hmm.
And probably now about 35 to 40% is.
And the blues isn't the music that you play after you've suffered.
No. But people get the idea. No, it has, you know, it has many moods and many attitudes. But the one thing I think it is not is self-pity.
Okay.
Never, you know. That's sort of like, to me, people used to say that American culture had emasculated the male. Tell Hank Aaron about that.
I'm wondering what you think of the kind of nostalgic approach to jazz of other eras that many people have. And by that, I think I mean fans, collectors, general interest listeners who are particularly caught up within the era of music that they grew up in. And that may be the music of the 40s, of the 50s, of the 30s,
mm-hmm.
are completely devoted to that music,
mm-hmm.
are pretty well informed about the music, and insist that that music is the best music that ever existed in the history of music. Nothing before it was ever better. Nothing past it will ever be better.
Yeah, they even say that whatever came before or after or one or the other isn't really jazz. That often happens. Well, I think, you know, everybody should outgrow the taste that he had when he was 16 years old in whatever field of interest he may have. You know, if you thought when you were 16 years old or 15 or younger that the greatest thing that ever happened was Superman comics, then with all due respect to Superman comics, I think it's time to maybe look around a little. And the same thing, I think, is true of jazz. You know, you can't measure art by style or the language of a given musical era, the musical language, I mean, that simply won't work. When I must admit that when I first heard Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie, that was a problem to me, because I felt something emotional in that music that I had not felt before, and I had to come to terms with it. It was a great lesson for me, believe me. It was a very great lesson for me to have to deal with that. It contributed greatly to my own emotional growth to do that. And I'm very grateful to them for that, because I learned. And that's, after all, what it's about. That's what aesthetic experience is about. They taught me things. But it wasn't easy at first. But I have not had so much of a problem otherwise. I mean, I didn't have any problem going backward. And I started that quite young. And I did not have any problem with the more recent revolution, sometimes called a new thing or whatever, you know. In fact, I think quite quickly I decided I liked Ornette Coleman very much and liked what he was doing in the late 50s and early 60s very much.
Have you frequently been in the position of finding yourself being the defender of someone like Ornette Coleman to people who think that it's music that is so unstructured to their ears, or so much like noise or chaos to their ears, that it must be noise or chaos and not music?
Yeah. Well, I guess a critic is always in that position to some extent, you know. I remember, you know, having to explain to people that about Thelonious Monk. We'll take him, and I'll get to on that in a second. But I've always loved Monk and had great respect for what he did. And people used to say to me, well, what he is trying to do is he's not doing, you know. And my answer to that always should have been, and sometimes actually was, well, when you can tell me what he's trying to do that he's not doing, I'll maybe respect what you're saying. But otherwise, what is it you're talking about? He's doing everything he wants to do. He may make an occasional mistake, but anybody's going to do that, particularly when they're improvising. But that's not what we're talking about here. Actually, Thelonious Monk threw away great quantity, handfuls of piano technique in order to be able to do what he wanted to do. Count Basie did the same thing before him. Count Basie was all over the keyboard like Earl Hines and Fats Waller and all those people. And then he said, oh, no, I'm going to distill this down to one little essence here, which he did, which is similar to what Monk did later. Those people are truly inimitable, by the way, because if you try to imitate those guys directly, you sound like you don't know what you're doing. But they never sound like they don't know what they're doing. Not really. But I guess I've only really been on the defensive with Ornette, and sometimes that still happens. That's particularly kind of dramatized by the fact, I guess is the right word, by the fact that there's a controversy still, and I've been hearing it today, over whether the real innovator is Coltrane or Coleman. And you still hear that. And I try to stay out of the argument and say what I like and don't like about each man and let it go with that. But ordinarily, I mean, I don't like to... most of the arguments that say, you know, so-and-so can't play or so-and-so can't play jazz or so-and-so, beyond a certain point, that's useless. It's like going back to square one and saying jazz isn't really good music. Castellanets fans have a way of saying that. They used to.
You know, it's always interesting the way the what's new and incomprehensible
mm-hmm.
in one year changes 10 years from then, and you can begin to hear what kind of order was in it and what kind of thought lay behind that. Yeah.
Isn't that true? I mean, Ornette's early Atlantic records now sound almost commonplace in terms of the techniques he's using. I mean, there's no problem with that for anybody. And you still get somebody say, well, he's playing out of tune. And you say, but wait a minute, didn't you hear that F there? That's right on the nose. Maybe he's inflecting those notes for a purpose. You know, that's not out of tune. You still hear a little bit. You don't even hear much of that anymore, you know.
Have you ever been shocked by how something changed over time in ways that you didn't think it would?
Yeah, I was shocked by this because actually it happened that just before that kind of thing started to happen, before Miles Davis made Kinda Blue and before Ornette made Shape of Jazz to Come, I had written an article for one of the Downbeat yearbooks on what I thought was going on that was important and where I thought it might lead. Now, I never write like to predict what musicians are going to do. I don't, you know, critics don't determine what happens. Musicians determine that. But I just was doing a little conjecturing, and I missed that coming. I missed that modal thing. I guess everybody did in a way. The interesting thing to me was, and this still fascinates me, and I can't possibly tell you why this happened, but the minute it happened independently in New York with Miles Davis and in L.A. with Ornette Coleman, very similar things, but very different in some ways, but very similar. The minute that happened, all of a sudden you began to get, on the one hand, these old-style Chicago blues singers who had been singing blues on three chords. All of a sudden they all stopped doing that and they began singing on one, simplifying their blues into that kind of modality. And you got people like the Beatles writing popular songs that were modal. And I was flabbergasted. I said, what is going on in music all of a sudden? When everybody, without any apparent cross-influence necessary, could have been, couldn't have been, you don't know, just everybody suddenly started doing that. But even if they did influence the each other, why would they suddenly start? What does that mean? Of course, the reduction to absurdity of all of that, by the way, by now, is disco, which has taken that same thing and turned it into the most appallingly monotonous thing musically I've ever heard in my life. It's just like, you know, disco is a dry run all night long. Nothing. I mean, it's like people to me saying, I wish I could tell you how this feels, but I don't think I can.
<You know? laughs> When you ask yourself that question, you know, how did this all happen, that simultaneously people playing mm-hmm. different kinds of music were reducing their structures or reducing the chords and mm-hmm. playing in a modal form, did you come up with any?
I have no idea.
Any response?
No, it
to
means
that
something very deep about 20th century human nature. It's got to, you know. I think I do not like the ordinary kind of sociological, anthropological interpretations of art that go on. I am not a Marxist, and I will say that loud and clear, and I'm not convinced by those interpretations. But I can say this, I think, very safely. Most of the black is beautiful things were said musically by funky people like Horace Silver before that ever became any political, you know. Art is related to the zeitgeist, as the Germans say it, undoubtedly. It's just how you interpret that fact that bothers me. And most people who interpret it are really grinding some kind of political acts of their own. But that's true to me. No question that the hard bop, funky people in New York were saying those things musically before they became generally conscious, you know. Now, what that modal thing says to me is we are going to have to go back to something very basic. We've lost touch with the earth, and we got to get our feet back on the ground. Now, you know, that's a tenuous generalization, but that's the best I'm willing to do with it. You remember that old peace symbol, the prong thing with the stick?
Yeah.
I used to look at that thing, and I would say, now, wait a minute. Is that plant growing, or is it sinking into the ground? Is it growing, or is it sinking into the unconscious? I didn't know, and I still don't know, but it's one or the other. I don't think anybody knows yet, you know.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Martin Williams. We're talking about music, about jazz. He has written extensively about jazz and is now the director of the Jazz and American Culture Program at the Smithsonian Institution. Let's take out a couple of minutes and listen to another one of the another selection from one of the albums you brought with you, and this is from the John Kirby Band. We're going to be hearing Kirby's version of Undecided. Do you want to tell us a little bit about this?
Well, you told me that you have played John Kirby's
records
before.
Yeah, I frequently played Kirby on
the air. That really surprises me, because a lot of people completely forgot about this little band that thrived on 52nd Street just before the so-called bebop came in with Parker and Gillespie. And it was formed in a little club on 52nd Street by some guys who had played with Fletcher Henderson's orchestra. And they played this marvelously precise kind of style. You know, I think this is light music. I'm not going to make any bones about that. I think it is marvelous, marvelous light music. I do not think jazz in general is light music. I do not think Duke Ellington is light music, although he played light pieces like anybody. But I think the Kirby Band is a kind of wondrous little light music experience, and I love it for that, you know. This particular thing was a big hit. Somebody wrote words to it. You know what the title means? Somebody said, what's the name of that piece, after they made the record? The record producer, or whatever he was called in those days, said, what is that you just played? And Charlie Shavers, who'd written this, probably said, that's Undecided. So he thought that was the title, and right, he didn't have a title. That's what that meant. You know, and in fact, another piece that was recorded the same date is just called From A Flat to C. Well, that's not a title. That's a description of the range of the piece, you know. But so it's surprising. This thing was a hit, and it's still played, as you know. But the original performance still delights me.
Okay, let's hear it. This is the John Kirby Band's recording of Undecided. Thank you. That's John Kirby's band from an album called The Biggest Little Band, 1937-41. It's material that has been released now on the Smithsonian Collection. And by the way, if you're interested in any of these recordings, they're available from the Smithsonian. They're not recordings that one would find in stores. You want to
just,
say any more about the...
call 800... No.
Do it before midnight.
You're right. And the first 500 will receive a copy of The Werewolf of Trenton. No. That's Jackie Gleason. You have to write to us, unless you're in Washington. And if you're in Washington, you can buy them through the Smithsonian shops. But our main business, you should excuse the expression, is mail order. And... if you don't know how to write this, just say Smithsonian Institution, Washington, D.C., and we'll get it sooner or later, recordings program. I got to say something about the alto saxophone player on that recording. Think about this. His name is Russell Prokope. Russell Prokope was a mainstay in the Fletcher Henderson Orchestra. Fletcher Henderson's orchestra invented the swing band. That's really where most of it comes from here. Russell Prokope was there participating in that. From there, he went to this marvelous little group here of John Kirby's and played this delightful precision music, which we have collected here from various sources, by the way. There's about 3, 4, or 5 different labels represented here. Then he went to Duke Ellington's orchestra, where he played for over 20 years. Now, what a career to have had in American music, with little or no recognition, because he was not a great soloist. And with Ellington, he's sitting there with Johnny Hodges, and you don't play much alto with him there, and you don't play much clarinet with Jimmy Hamilton there, which was the case in the beginning, although he did, Prokope took over the clarinet role after Jimmy Hamilton left. So, you know, he was not famous, and many people who know Ellington's music fairly well have never heard of him. But there he is. Now, a man like that, to me, my goodness, what a life in the music of the United States. He's a very great man to me, very great man. And it's not just a matter of his having been at the right place at the right time, you know. I mean, he was involved, and yet very few people have ever heard of him.
It's funny, some records that go back to different periods, you know, that are reissues, have the kind of detailed liner notes and personnel descriptions where you can find out more about what you're hearing, but it seems that a lot of recent albums aren't really paying much attention to that. I mean, you really have to figure things out for yourself, like, you know, guess who some of the personnel are and...
I think record companies decided that that was a lot of pedantic nonsense. It was alienating people. They figured they couldn't listen to jazz and enjoy it unless they knew the leader's blood type and the drummer's girlfriend's name and all this stuff. And I don't agree. I like to read about music if it's well written, but most liner notes, I think, are balderdash, to put it politely, for the sake of radio.
Martin Williams, when you are listening to music, not for professional reasons, like when you have the time to like step out of your professional roles, I don't know if
what
if
did
you
I
see
play
that
at
as
home
being
the other night?
I don't know if you see that as being divided or not. But what are some of the things that you're spending your time listening to now?
I will almost always try to listen to Sarah Vaughan. Whenever there's a new record, whenever she is available to me live, I think Sarah Vaughan is one of the greatest singers I have ever heard of any kind in any music. And I see her, and I always try to hear her records. Her recording career is very uneven, but that's okay. I'm answering the question. I go out of my way to listen to Hank Jones play solo. Hank Jones, to me, is one of the greatest living pianists. Now, I don't mean the trio records, where he plays bebop piano. He does it beautifully, but I've had enough of that. Hank Jones is like Art Tatum and Bud Powell all rolled into one player when he is playing solo, and he is superb. He thrills me. So, you know, my taste is eclectic. I love some of Keith Jarrett's things, but I do not love them all. And, you know, on down the line, there's a young piano player named Stanley Cowell who absolutely, he's just flabbergasting, that young man. Etc. You know, that's what I listen to for pleasure. But I may go pull something out of the shelf from 1928, and I may listen to George Gershwin play the piano. because sometimes Gershwin played very good piano, you know, not always. I may listen to a complete recording of Turandot, which I just bought recently and paid real money for. And I don't often pay money for records, you know. I'm like you, I get records. But I paid for that, and I'm not sorry. I love that opera. You know, I listen to a lot of things.
Okay. Well, listen, I want to thank you very much for coming to Fresh Air this afternoon. It's really been a great pleasure to have you here and to be able to share some of your experiences. Thanks for being here. My guest has been Martin Williams. He is the director of the Jazz and American Culture Program at the Smithsonian Institution, where he does a number of things, including compiling various albums of recorded music, and that includes not only the Smithsonian Collection of Classic Jazz, but also albums of music from the stage. He has also written extensively about jazz in books like The Jazz Tradition. He's the editor of the Jazz Masters series, and also the author of Where's the Melody, and has also written extensively for magazines and periodicals. Thanks again for being here.